good to see you. Yeah.
Hey,
what's up?
Chilling.
Well, the important question first, how's Jennifer doing?
She's doing great. I mean, she really was doing great from the beginning. So for, I mean, I guess what you're referring to is the car accident. My girlfriend, Jennifer Holland, who everybody can watch tonight on CMT's Sun Records, was in a car accident on the PCH like 3 weeks ago, and she had to be airlifted by helicopter to the hospital, which is, I was out to dinner and got this message. I'm like, oh, my God. And her car was crushed. A truck landed on top of her car.
Oh, my God.
And it was, like, completely crushed, but the little tiny part of it that was okay was the part where she was sitting. So she was actually she's just fine.
Oh, God.
It was pretty scary, though. Pretty scary.
James, I've got to ask you this question. The metal sheet covering the building, is that adamantium?
Believe me, I thought of it. It all comes together. Yes. Marvel will love that I'm saying the Belcour experiment is part of the MCU.
So I have to ask you, James. It's already been said that, you know, the initial inspiration for this film came from your dreams.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, how do you?
I dreamt the trailer for anybody.
Okay. This, I mean, number one, I'm scared about what dreams you're having, but
they get worse than that. That's
I'm sure,
and better, much better.
But then you take that visual concept and idea that you had, then you meld it with the Milgram experiment. Essentially,
yeah, sure,
the Milgram experiment,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Which
yeah.
are beyond fascinating. I'm curious
yeah.
about that process of that marriage of the visual and then tracking down Milgram's work
yeah.
and bringing that in.
Well, listen, I mean, there's been a lot of experiments that have been outside the bounds of what is normally considered ethical. And something about me, which is, you know, sort of horrifies me about myself, is I'm really interested in what people did in those extreme situations.
Yeah.
And being a writer, I think this is simply an exploration of what would people do in this particular extreme exploration? And as broad of an idea as it is, treating it as seriously as possible. And I was lucky to have a bunch of actors with me who treated it equally seriously. Without them, I think the movie would not work. So I think it was not a really pleasant writing experience, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It was a much more pleasant filming experience because it was really dark days, people crying, and then we went off and had fun, and it was just the best group of real actors I've ever been around. But the process of writing it was not, you know, it's like, you know, I love my characters. I fall in love with my characters, and to be able to be creating these characters while simultaneously slaughtering them. I'm really the voice. I'm the one who's making them do this stuff, and it was not unpleasant.
Well, while writing this, how did you? Was there anything that was too far? So I just saw this in New York 2 days ago.
Yeah.
By the way, you know I love horror. You gave me a fucking panic attack
at
one point in this theater. Like I actually walked out and got a drink of water
at one point.
No, in a good way. It's very rare that movies like this affect me in that way. Was there anything that you wrote that maybe you were like too far?
I think that no. No, not that I wrote. I think there were things that when we were going through the cut of the film, there were moments that we knew it's a very delicate balance.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's tastes are different. I think this movie's going to be way too extreme for a lot of people. But you want to be careful that there's enough emotion and really like love between the characters to balance the horror of what's happening on screen. So with some emotion and some comedy, you can kind of pull back from it a little bit. But at the same time, you know, and you don't want to be hitting that same key on the piano again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very delicate balance with the execution scene because it was incredibly long scene in the way they shot it. And, you know, Tony Goldwyn is going around and picking people, and his picking, it was just like very fascinating about him taking a long time to try to figure out who he was going to choose and why. But it did get to, it got to be too much, you know, and the same thing with him shooting people, just, it got to be too much for me, and I use myself as a barometer, and that's a pretty high barometer. There were times during the cutting that things were too much, but during shooting, no, not so much.
What does a film like this afford you? Because you're doing this big budget, blah, 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 and then there's this low budget film, which is a little more about human nature, you know. So what do you get from this one?
I would say they're both about human nature. I would say that, you know, for me, you know, in all honesty, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is the most personal film I've ever made by far. I had 100% creative freedom, mostly 100% financial freedom to create whatever was in my brain. So there's a very personal relationship I have to it. But being able to make a totally different movie that's a totally different direction, that touches a totally different series of nerves, allowed me during the making of Guardians to be able to jump back and forth between two things, and each serves the other. For 3 years, I've done nothing practically but make Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, from the writing through the pre-production, production, and now the editing. And so being able to go down to Columbia for a month and be in a completely different environment, it's like, you know, when you focus at one spot on the wall for too long, it becomes three spots. And that's the thing I'm trying to avoid. So it was a way of, like, cleaning my brain so that I could go on. And at the same time, I've learned so much since I was making, you know, simply, you know, independent films about movies in general. To be able to go and do Belko, I was able to apply what I had learned there on that movie. So they really work really well together, as different as they may seem. And I like, you know, I love old time, I like Howard Hawks, you know, he's one of my favorite movie directors because he was able to switch between genres and do completely different things. My only regret is that I don't have more years of my life, because there's a lot of things that I want to do that I simply don't have the time to do.
Are you a fan of thought experiments, specifically the trolley problem?
I mean, what is it? What is it?
You have three people bound.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yes. Yeah, and that's a big thing.
That's what you open with, essentially.
That is what this movie is. It's that to a great degree. It's a strange thing. It's a little bit, you know, this movie is a little bit different. Because I think in those, if that was a reality, I think I would probably be a bit more utilitarian in what I would personally choose to do. In this situation, it's pretty futile, like what they're doing. Like, there's a desperation in the murdering of each other. That you know, is difficult, I think that I'm more like John Gallagher is in the movie than if I was in this same situation.
I was gonna say that's why he kind of mulls it over in his head as to who's gonna choose to kill and not, right?
Yeah, to me that was the biggest thing about the Mike Milch character, is he's this guy who's just always thinking, and he's like that in his daily life, but it's also what allows him to survive, and it also makes him compassionate, is reason. And he's constantly, you can see John doing it in the movie, he's just constantly thinking. And everybody else is like freaking out when the voice comes on, and then when he's getting the back of his head sewn, but you see him, and he just kind of lifts his ear, and he's like listening, he's looking for what's going on and what the truth is. And I think that's, he did an amazing job in the film because of that.
That's great.
You know, I'm curious, James, because all of your characters and all your films are so close to you and are your children, how difficult was it to have somebody else direct Belko? And how did you go about finding Greg and knowing he was the one?
Well, you know, I it was difficult, but not as difficult. When I was purely a screenwriter, and not a producer, I hated it, frankly. You know, it was like, you know, writing the first half of a novel and having somebody come in and finish writing that novel in the way they wanted, changing everything around, and not really understanding where you were coming from in the first draft. It just felt like I was telling the first half of the story and not being able to finish it. And sometimes things came out okay, but different than what I anticipated, but usually things just came out as a milkier version of what I saw in my head. And I'm a very visual person, so oftentimes I start with drawing pictures before I ever even write words. So it was difficult. This time it was a little bit easier because, number one, I had the knowledge that I was probably never going to have time to direct a Belko experiment myself. And number two, I was able to produce and, you know, sort of work with Greg and help to make the movie, make sure he understood where I was coming from when I wrote a certain scene and how I saw a certain character, how I saw something, and I chose Greg. You know, usually the director was chosen by someone else. And in this case, I got to meet with a bunch of directors, and I thought that Greg and I saw eye to eye on the most things, and in how the most important part of the movie was the character and the the relationships between those characters and keeping it real and grounded. And so that's where that came from. But it was a new experience. It was difficult because I'd never done it before. I've never written and truly produced. But it was a good experience overall.
Going back off of the characters, how did you and Greg work together with the casting? Because, you know, you brought in some familiar faces. Also, I was pretty surprised that Rooker was rather tame. I really kind of thought he was going to go in there and mess some stuff up. But how did you guys work together with that?
Well, I wanted Michael Rooker to play it. Michael Rooker's a good person in the movie.
I know.
Yeah.
And he's a fantastic...
I loved that.
He's a fantastic good person. And when you guys see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, you will agree with what I say now, which is Michael Rooker deserves a Best Supporting Actor nomination for his role in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Wow.
He is an amazing actor. It's the role of a lifetime for him. And he is, you know, someone that every single person that sees the movie loves. Totally separate thing. I wanted to see Rooker play somebody that's basically a good guy. And he is. He's basically a good guy. And I like that. I like this hip playing against his type. Wait, what was the other part of your...
Oh, about... how the two of you collaborated on casting this.
Oh, well, I mean, I think casting was something I pretty much took the lead on. I think that Greg knows that that's one of my strengths, you know? And so, first of all, I just cast all my friends. And I cast, you know, John Gallagher Jr. was somebody who came in who auditioned for Peter Quill on the first Guardians of the Galaxy. He was not at all right for the role, but it was probably the best... audition I'd ever seen in my entire life, maybe until Pam Clementia for Guardians 2. And I'm like, I have to work with this guy. So when this movie came up, I cast him because of that. You know, there's people like Brent Sexton, who I've known for many years, who I really love and wanted to put him in the movie. Rusty Schwimmer's been my friend for 15 years, and I've never been able to work with her, so I have. I was able to put Joe Freya in there, who's in PG Porn, who I've known for a long time, and Stevie Blackheart and Valentine Neely, and all these people are people, Michaela Hoover, who I've worked with for a long time and know well, my brother Sean Rooker.
And Simon got an executive producer credit.
Simon
awesome.
Was a co-producer in the movie, yeah. Awesome. Simon was my assistant, and now he's my producing partner, and he's been producing stuff with me, so it was a way to kind of give people the opportunity to do something that they hadn't been given the opportunity to do before, me to be able to work with them the way I had. But also, you know, working with Tony Goldwyn, who isn't somebody who was really on my radar before this, has become a really close friend since that time, and is a guy I just love as a person. And he was really the team leader down there in terms of the whole cast. And you know, when you have the person who's first on you know, the call list being such a great guy, everybody else kind of has to fall into line.
Yeah.
And I think it's true with Guardians with Chris Pratt, and I think it was true in Belco with Tony. And he's just a great person to be around. So I made some new friends. Audrey, I think, is like every day I saw her on set, was just astounded by her work, and maybe the best actress I've ever worked with. So there's a lot of new people that I hope to work with again and again. And all the time we're talking about, we got to find an ensemble thing. We got to find an ensemble thing just so we can take all these people who unfortunately were killed and put them in another movie together because we had a great time making the movie. And I think that almost all the cast would say that same thing. It's just it's such a dark thing, but we had a great time around it.
It makes you wonder if that's why Ryan Murphy does it, you know? Because he has everyone come back for multiple things with different storylines.
Yeah, right.
Going back to what you're saying about wanting to explore different genres and stuff, I'm sure Marvel probably has you, like, locked for a good chunk of time. Are you going to look into a departure after Guardians Volume 2, or are you going to possibly do something like you did with Belco, or produce something that is something you wrote?
I'm definitely going to do another smaller project like Belco that like takes up a small amount of my time. Right now, I'm thinking very seriously about doing a TV pilot with my brother Brian, and there's a good chance that's going to happen. But other than that, I'm figuring out if I'm going to do Guardians 3. It's there, and so I will figure it out probably in the next couple of weeks. You know, but I certainly love the Guardians and feel very creatively fulfilled with the guys at Marvel, and they've been great to me. So it all, you know, All I know is I don't want to make a big movie next. I don't want to make it. I really honestly don't want to go, and I don't have that desire to go make a movie that I'm shooting for 24 days. I like making big movies where I can have imagined things that I can make, you know, exactly like how I want them to be. So that excites me.
I had that conversation actually with my friend who likes your work on Guardians, but I told him, like, well, I like his R-rated stuff too. You know, I like Super and all that good stuff. So now we have, R-rated superhero movies. I mean, what is your take on that? I mean, would you ever push that envelope? You know, because you have your R-rated side into the
world. I think the thing is that, I'm going to come off cocky in a second, but I think the thing we got to start framing it as is R-rated movies pushing the envelope in any way.
Mm.
You know, from my money, I love the Belko experiment, but Guardians of the Galaxy definitely pushed the envelope more than something that's the most extreme movie I ever made.
Mm.
And the reason being is because it was more unique. It was more, you know, it was, the Belko's a unique movie, but it was doing something that another spectacle film had never done in terms of tonally, with the music, with the characters, with the way we treated them, with the colors. And I think Volume 2, twice as much as that. So I don't think of R-rated movies as pushing any boundaries. They're just more violent.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean I wouldn't love to do if it was the right project, do an R-rated superhero movie? If it was the right project, sure. Mm-hmm. You know. And in fact, I think there's some characters in the Marvel Cosmic Universe, which is my area of interest, that would make great R-rated movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about it, frankly, which is going to be all anybody's going to say once they read these articles. But, you know, I mean, we've talked about it. And so just talk. You know, we talk about everything and the different ways we can go with the cosmic side of Marvel. And, you know, I think that the great thing about Marvel is every movie's a different genre, a different type of film.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the Guardians movies are. And so I think that there's always that opportunity to make an R-rated movie that's really cool. And I think that we've been very fortunate in that the two movies that have been rated R, they're superhero movies, are Logan and Deadpool.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both, well, listen, my movie Super was R-rated,
yeah.
Defender was R-rated, Kick-Ass was R-rated. But in terms of the mainstream superhero movies, those movies are both really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're two of my favorite, if not my favorite, you know, couple of movies from, you know, the past couple of years. So, not my, or at least favorite superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they do both push boundaries in other ways, other than the violence. Deadpool especially pushes the boundaries in a lot of ways. I read that script, you know, Rhett Reese gave me that script, you know, 6 years ago, and I read it and I couldn't believe it. Not because of the violence, although I was surprised. I'm like, how? Because they were planning on making it PG-13 at the time. Not because of the violence, but because of breaking the frame. To me, that's more, way more, you know, groundbreaking than, you know, the violence in the movie, you know. So, anyway,
thank you.
You know, putting on your producer's hat, James, were there any logistical challenges from a producing standpoint you faced going down to Bogota?
Oh, my God, it's so many. First of all, it's a different language. So not everybody on set spoke your language. Like, there was a day when I got kind of pissed off and I was yelling at people about the little corn cob dude in there. Because I had a specific way I drew the corn cob dude. And I'm like, you need to do the corn cob dude like this. I don't care about these actors. I'm really mostly concerned with corn cob dude. To me, corn cob dude is the star of the movie. And you got to treat him with respect. And he's a character I love. You heathens. And they made a shitty corn cob dude. And I'm like, I drew corn cob dude. Why didn't you make him like how I want it? And I was like yelling, which I do occasionally. And then I realized nobody understands what I'm saying. The poor prop person is over here and they're like, oh, you know, what's this? I'm doing something bad and I'm just trying to figure out what it is. Like, it's corn cob dude. You know, corn cob dude doesn't translate very easily from Spanish. Yeah, so that's a huge thing. It's a crew that was great and passionate. It works at a different pace than crews in L.A. or England do, where I've made a lot of my movies. But also, we made the movie on incredibly low budget, and having to, you know, build the sets and do all the stuff that we needed to do for the movie was It was a hassle. It was very difficult.
I want to ask about that. Do you find yourself being more resourceful when you have less money to work with than when you have a big budget?
Yeah, I do. I do. And that's unfortunate, I think, because I think there's a lot of wasted money on big productions. And, it's been a very thing. It's been difficult for me to learn how to do it. I think on low budget productions, the first movie I ever made was a movie called Tromeo and Juliet. And because we didn't have any money, I was a music supervisor on that movie. So I went to all the bands myself and, had bands like Motorhead and Sublime and bands that were big at the time on the soundtrack. And I did the whole soundtrack basically for free, for, I think, $50. All those guys made money because the soundtrack actually sold. But to be in the movie, we just didn't have any movie. It was a $300,000 movie we were making. And I got it all for free. And now it's like people...
they want everything.
It's like, once they hear Marvel's coming, it's like, oh, dollar sign. I'm like, no, our albums go double platinum. We don't, the difference between the first Guardian soundtrack and the second Guardian soundtrack in terms of the budget is pretty big. I had to scrape for stuff back then because I didn't have any other option. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to an artist and I said, listen, we can pay you nothing, or I cannot have you be in the movie. I wasn't bluffing. I meant it because I really couldn't afford to pay them even $500. Like, for real, I couldn't afford to pay them $500. And I think that is everything. I mean, you learn how to do things for practically nothing. It also can be a little unfair because a lot of people are working for nothing, man. And it never leads to anything. And they learn, which is great. But you want people to be compensated fairly. But also things get overblown and they end up spending a lot of money on things that aren't necessary. And that can be difficult. And for me, something that when I came into Marvel, I think probably one of the things they were most surprised by was that I went through every budget item. In part because I'm incredibly controlling, but in part because I don't want to see that we're spending, $200,000 on some prop that doesn't really matter when we can't afford to build our $800,000 set that really does mess, So it wasn't anything about being financially conservative. It was about creative choices that are also financial choices. And coming from my background producing movies and independent film, that is a part of the creative conversation for me.
That's all the time we have, guys.
Oh, I'm so sorry, you guys. I didn't get... I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I didn't feel your...
There were good questions.
Yes.
Great.
Super.
Yeah. No sequel, James?
Thank you.
Sequel?
To Belko?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
If the people want it, we got it. I got it all in my head. It's all there. I know what's happening.
James.
All
right.
And I want more blood. I want
more blood.
More blood?
More blood. Good to see you.
It's like, the thing for me with the movie is that it's like the most harrowing scene is the scene where he's executing those people.
Yeah.
It's almost all on Tony's face.
I know.
There's actually not that much blood, but it's like more disturbing to me. So
yeah.
Like, it's funny because Slither is a way gorier movie than Belko. But
at one point with the axe in the face, like
yeah.
For some reason, all
that
of
is pretty good.
I
yeah,
was
yeah.
so
cool.
I took a second,
so cool.
Like I text
yeah.
Stevie. I go, I just saw this, and I go, you guys suck.
But it feels good.
But it was awesome.
I love when she does that. Like,
thank
fuck that guy. That guy
awesome.
Is every
was
fucking
awful.
Sexist perv in every office.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry. All right. Awesome.
Yeah.